Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Achtung, achtung. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk USA with me, Al Murray, James Holland and John McManus. It's a big year this year, isn't it, John?
Absolutely.
I mean, last year on the podcast, we tried to make a fuss out of 1943. And to be honest, I think it was just us. Whereas...
No, it was a massive year. It was massive. What are you saying?
No, but you know what I mean, Jim.
No, 43 really was a big year.
No, really, listen. No, come back. No. No, I'll buy you another drink.
Right. I'll buy you two. A whole bottle. Just listen, please.
You and I were convinced.
We don't have to contrive this, do we? This is no. 80th anniversary stuff. 80th anniversary of D-Day. We'll all be there. And in my case, I'll be with the World War II Museum's 80th anniversary cruise, which, believe it or not, actually has a few openings even at this late stage.
Wow.
Really?
So I wanted to mention that. Yeah, it's really, really going to be cool. Well, there's a pre-tour in Hamburg that starts May 27th.
Strong.
The actual tour begins in Hamburg, I think, like May 29th or 30th. And then, you know, we go to these excursions. One of the things that I think is really exciting, we're going to East Anglia and going to Thorpe Abbott's, the home of the 100th Bomb Group.
Aha, which is obviously very good.
The unit portrayed in Masters of the Air. And so I'm one of the featured historians, along with Don Miller, who obviously is the author of Masters of the Air. We're going to have Alex Ritchie, who we all know so well, and Keith Lowe, the amazing Keith Lowe. So we'll be, you know, at the ceremonies, the cemetery on June 6th. There will be an Omaha Beach hike with me on June 5th, I think it is. We'll go like WN62, wow. 60. And also, you know, the Battlefield Historians. I'm not sure exactly who will be part of the Omaha Beach hike. That may be, you know, closer to time they figure that out. But we'll have a nice group, and this is just going to be a lot of fun. So, I mean, I'm amazed there's even anything open at this point. I don't think it'll last very long, but I just wanted to mention it.
Okay, that sounds great.
Well, there we go. Well, that sounds fantastic.
That'll be a good trip. I mean, they're always superbly run by Sarah Kirksey, who is just a genius at this stuff, and she always looks after everyone really, really well. And everyone who goes on that, from the punters to the historians, are all absolutely top notch. So I can't recommend it highly enough.
And it's because I think they understand how to maximize the skill set of everybody. the battlefield historians, guys like Pierre Samuel Nathanson or Sylvan Cast or Christoph Gosselin or whoever, who basically live there and know these areas inside and out and know the history. The authors, of course, like all of us who can maybe speak to that side of it too. And then luxury travel so that it's fun for all of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, really tough duty to be on a luxurious cruise ship or in a, you know, on a castle or whatever. Because Jim, you and I are doing Normandy Seine next year with them.
Yes, we are.
And it's the exact same kind of thing. Mm. And it's just, I mean, I really enjoy it from that standpoint. It's also just like we have Ways Fest. It's an opportunity for all of us to get to know a lot of the folks who are on the other end of the podcast listening.
Yeah.
Or reading our books or whatever. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And it's very easy to find these trips. National World War II Museum. I can't remember if it's called .org or whatever, but I mean, if you just Google National World War II Museum, it'll come right up. Today, we're going to talk about, we thought we'd talk about the experience of American combat troops, specifically the infantry, I think, really. I mean, you've done all that work on that. You did a book called Grunts. You've done your work on Omaha Beach. You've done the Battle of the Bulge. You've done all the stuff you've done in the Pacific, of course, but you've also done that special look at the 7th Infantry Regiment, part of the US 3rd Infantry Division. So, John, I guess, you know, you're pretty well placed to talk about this stuff.
God, I'd hope so after all these years. I mean, it's been a lot of time in the mud, figuratively speaking, you know, with the grunt's perspective.
And let's face it was awful, wasn't it? I mean, it was.
Oh my God!
If you're an infantryman, longer I study it, the war is terrible.
It's I mean, I just think it's very hard for those of us who weren't there and part of it to relate to it. I think still, even as much as we know of how personal this was, how degrading in a way, because you know the infantry just lives out there in the middle of this mess, and I mean that's tough enough. Just much less really. All the danger you're facing. And you know what I mean? Like we talked about that in Italy and I have in the Pacific.
Absolutely. Well, I was literally just writing about a guy this morning. He's actually a German paratrooper rather than an American. You know, he's up on Monte Cassino and he's got diarrhea. He's got the runs. The bombers come over, but he's gripped. So he doesn't want to do anything in his pants. So he runs off to the kind of, you know, company latrine, which is sort of very much open to the elements. And he sat there with his pants down. And suddenly the bomb has come open and he's looking up and he can literally see the bombs falling on him. I mean, they're, you know, they're not actually falling on him, but it looks like it. And his mates are yelling at him. And so pulls up his trousers and pegs it and manages to make cover just in the nick of time. But I mean, how degrading is that? Mm. I mean, it's just, it's horrendous, isn't it? And the losses.
It really is.
The rotation troops. I mean, statistically, frontline infantrymen, you're not going to survive unscathed.
You're not. You're going to be, what Omar Bradley said, on the litter or in the grave. I mean, that's the way you're getting out in World War II. In Vietnam, you would have had a tour of duty and you'd hope to survive that time duration. In Korea, you could get enough points, which is from time on the line.
What was a tour of duty in the Vietnam?
So if you're Army, it's generally 12 months. If you're Marine, it could be 13 months. Although if you're like from a Fleet Marine Force unit, you might deploy for 4 to 6 months. But typically for most Marines, it's 13 months. So, you know, if you could make it through that duration and statistics were on your side, you can go home. In the 21st century, your unit rotates in and out. So that's usually 6 months or 15 at the outset. But in World War II, most infantrymen didn't have that kind of rotation. And that's what really strikes me about it so much in this war. There's really nothing to look forward to. I mean, as bad as it's been with the bomber crews we've been talking about, Masters of the Air and all that, I mean, of course, it's terrible. But there was still a tour of duty, possibly might fry your missions and go home.
Why weren't the tours of duty? Just because there's not enough numbers to do it.
Yeah, I mean, they need infantry so badly, combat soldiers as a whole, that they just generally don't have a tour of duty. Now, there's some exceptions. In the Marines in the Pacific, if you are in two operations, it's possible you could be eligible to be rotated home. You might always be ordered back too, or volunteer. But and in some cases, you have some lucky infantry units that have a rotation or whatever in the Army, but it's rare. So yeah, I mean, and of course, as the war develops, as you guys know, we just never have enough of these guys.
Yeah,
and so
sure,
and part of it is shipping too. Everything comes back to shipping, right?
Yeah,
we can't afford to allot ships to send guys home.
It is striking because I've got some numbers in front of me. Fourth Infantry Division in Europe for 11 months, they lose 4,834 killed, 17,371 injured, which is 18.1% and 65.1% respectively. But those figures stick across, are essentially truthful for all the divisions in Europe. That's a rate you can expect top to bottom. When you think it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. But if you think about the 4th Infantry Division, I mean, they're a really good one because they famously or infamously have more injuries in the training exercises in Devon than they do on D-Day. But boy, do they make up for the kind of easy landing. Within 2 weeks, I think their rifle companies are 100% casualties. You know, 100%.
Getting in the fight to Cherbourg.
So if you're thinking about an infantry division being about 16,000 men, I guess around just under 10,000 are infantry. You know, that's in your three infantry regiments. Not infantry, infantry regiments, aren't they? So in your infantry regiments, you also have clerks and all the rest of it. So actually, your fighting battalions, what is it? British infantry battalion is 845 men, four companies.
US is about the same, maybe 900 or so. But of course, a lot of them are not actually riflemen or machine gunners who are doing most of the fighting. And so the way I've figured it, maybe about 3,500 to 4,000 even in a division are really doing most of the fighting, are in the rifle companies advancing when we attack kind of thing. And they absorb most of the casualties, even more than mortarmen, more than, you know, all the supporting arms we've got of engineers and whatever else. So artillery. So, I mean, that's where it becomes even more stark. I go over this in a class I teach about grunts and go over this statistically with the students. And when they look at it that way, you could see that as a rifleman, you have basically no chance, statistically speaking, of not getting hit. Really no chance. And that's just in an ordinary unit. You know, Al mentioned the 4th Division, which is fairly typical, you know, for European theater. In the European theater, at a minimum, we had 56% casualties among riflemen in all the divisions that saw action. I mean, that's like, wow. The absolute mean average microcosm unit in the entire U.S. Army in World War II is the 77th Infantry Division, Statue of Liberty in the Pacific. You know, if you ever saw Hacksaw Ridge, the famous medic Desmond Doss. Okay, so 77 saw a lot of fighting, and their casualties are exactly average. And you're talking, you know, I don't have them in front of me, but there are thousands killed in action. In other words, if you're a rifleman in the 77th, you probably have about 150% to 200% chance of becoming a casualty. If you're in the division, 50 to 100% chance.
It circles this round to the question of, let's say you're wounded and you're patched up. How long is it before you're back in the line then? Because obviously that's a manpower question that's incredibly important here, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it really depends where and when we're talking about. And what kind of orders the medical people have and whether they're going to comply with them and what kind of, you know, like institutional pressures are. If you, let's say the three of us are hit and we go back for medical treatment, I think there's some times in the war where there's sort of a lull and we can maybe loll around in the hospital for weeks on end and convalesce. But we're likely, if we're going back anywhere at all, the biggest priority the three of us would have is to go back to our unit, the same unit, rather than be sent in somewhere as a faceless replacement, which happens sometimes. But I would say more often than not, there's institutional pressure to get the three of us back as soon as we can physically handle it. And there's times where it's borderline unbelievable. Merrill's Marauders in Burma is a really good example because you have the basically an infantry regiment type of formation that, like any other, has been decimated in a few weeks of combat. And yet, unlike every other theater, you're not getting replacements. You're getting nothing. So you can imagine the pressure then on the medical professionals to take the three of us who probably have now malaria, yellow fever, in addition to our wounds. It's like, you've got 103 fever and you've got some bleeding cuts from portions of your body, but you can stand, you can manipulate a weapon. We're taking the wound tag off you and you're going back to Mitkina. You know, I mean, it's just really ruthless sometimes.
Well, I mean, one of the things I found, in my reading, I found really, really interesting, John, is the way that the American Army surveyed its men and asked it questions and sort of, you know, asked its opinions and how it felt about stuff. There's this amazing table of fear symptoms that from the South and Central Pacific, you know, where they ask men what symptoms they experience when they're, in combat. And that, I mean, I find it absolutely, you know, that feels very modern, right? That feels, you know, one of the things I think we think about the 1940s is that, you know, that people weren't that interested in that kind of stuff. That's a sort of, that feels like a modern question to be asking people. But there's a lot of that going on in the American army, isn't there? They're really trying to get inside people's heads, figure out how best to take care of them and keep them going, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, it is part of them. It's the surprising modernity of the age. And maybe that's what kind of draws us to it. I don't know. But it's a real triumph for the social scientists whose fields are fairly new. By the 1940s, they've been around, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, maybe, the social psychologists in particular, and Samuel Stouffer being the lead among them, is going to lead this team to basically survey American service people about, and not just combat people, but everybody, about everything you can imagine, including race, including, you know, food and attitudes about our allies. I mean, whatever. And all of this is by the way, now available under a major effort that they put together at Virginia Tech.
So, John, what is the name of this archive? Where, what would I... You know, what do I have to put into my laptop to find it?
So it's called American Soldier WW2, like numeral 2.org.
Yep.
Right. And it's, you know, part of the part of Virginia Tech. So again, cool. American Soldier WW2.org. It's amazing. The basic of the effort is that they've digitized most of the actual surveys, the original surveys, if not all. And then there's also articles accompanying it to give you perspective and utilize some of this data and whatnot. It's really, really an amazing effort, a good public service. So you can really dig in. So in the old days, like when I was doing my dissertation, I mean, I was just looking at the published data about this, and but also some of the original survey material, which is in the National Archives. Now, like I said, you can get it all digitized, and it's really cool stuff. So yeah, I mean, what's neat about it is that it's systematic survey statistical analysis. Like you said, Al, here's the top five symptoms of fear in combat that people report, you know, like incontinence or the opposite. Yeah.
Violent pounding of the heart. Violent pounding of the heart, sinking feeling in the stomach, shaking or trembling all over, feeling sick at the stomach, cold sweat, feeling weak or faint, feeling stiff, vomiting, losing control of bowels, urinating in pants. And it's so interesting, isn't it? Because also, if it is a different age, then I'm sure men have different attitudes to what they'll tell a survey, what they'll admit to. Yet, yet you do have 21% of men in Division A, South Pacific, out of a survey of 2,095 men, 21% saying, yeah, I lose control of my bowels when I'm frightened.
Admitting
to it. I think it is that occasional glimpse into a very, into a very modern world, or that modernity asserting itself in order to help win the war, like with the technological advances. It's the same thing. You know, when you're in the clinch, you reach for the new ways of examining things and new ways of investigating things. So compelling. US soldiers' attitudes to enemy weapons. Percentage you rated it most frightening. It's frightening and dangerous. So the 48% think it's frightening. 62% think it's dangerous. Dive bomber, 20% frightening, 17% dangerous. So they've got a grip on the dive bomber, these lads. I mean... they're surprisingly blasé about mortars. 13% frightening, 6% dangerous. We know perfectly well how dangerous mortars are.
I mean, I was enthralled with this. Like we're saying today, I'm like, my gosh, this exists. And so I was trying to line it up with the contemporary sources that we all value so much, but also my interviews with the people I knew, and trying to fit it together. And it's it's really a different view of the war on some levels, and somehow more unvarnished, and especially in relation to attitudes about what to do with the Japanese after the war, where a substantial portion are saying, eliminate it from the face of the earth, eliminate Japan from the face of the earth or whatever, or, you know, attitudes about race, which is not what we'd want them to be in this day and age. And what's interesting is you've got all that statistical analysis that shows you X percent say this and that, but you also have the comments. And I think sometimes the comments are more interesting, of course, more subjective.
Sure.
You know, I found one, this was during the trilogy research, and I was looking at the original survey material, like in the National Archives. And, so these were people in hospital, in the Marianas. And I found several actually that were really just sort of like plaintive cries for help almost. You know, I have no treatment here. I have no hope. They're going to send me back and I'll be killed. it's also unfair. You know, you can imagine somebody in a hospital room or whatever filling this out and thinking, yeah, why am I doing this? Maybe just hoping somebody will read it and do something about it, you know, and it's really very moving.
The idea of a survey where you could literally read between the lines like that is very interesting, isn't it? Is that they, again, they left room in it for that kind of personal detail. Gosh, what a thing, eh, Jim?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely amazing.
Isn't it?
Blown James's mind, John.
I just can't believe this is new to me. But John, just to kind of rewind a little bit. Okay. So, you know, it's the spring of 1942. My draft papers turned up. I'm a college graduate. I'm not a college graduate. What's my route? What happens to me? You know, it's just the draft. So how do I end up being a dog face?
Yeah.
But how do I end up being a dog face officer? More to the point. I mean, if I'm smart and I've got a college degree, what the hell am I doing in the infantry? Why end up being a fighter pilot or an engineer or gunnery officer?
Well, you may want to do one of those other things, but we need infantry eventually. I mean, it's spring of 42 at that point. I mean, we're really trying to channel most of what we think of as our quality manpower to the Army Air Forces.
Yes, indeed.
And that's the priority for about the next year and a half or so. So when you enter the Army, you take the Army General Classification Test, which is basically like a quick IQ test, extremely culturally biased, as you can imagine, for the era. But, you know, you basically have a score that is analogous to the IQ. So to be eligible for officer candidate school, I think you have to score 110 or above, either that or maybe 115, but like around there. Most people score somewhere in the 90s. Where you're going to go next kind of depends what your draft board has recommended, what you're classified of. They have all these different classifications, the most famous being 1A, of course.
Yes.
But you might have a more limited service classification, meaning you're going to be entered in the military, but we're not going to really send you overseas or whatever. So a lot of this is the physical fitness, too, you may have. But the bottom line for you is, as we get going in this war, we have this voracious need for ground combat troops. And so we're going to start channeling as much manpower as we can away from the AAF and away from Army Service Forces, which is also getting more than its share, towards Army Ground Forces. And this is what General Leslie McNair has to battle the entire war. It's like, you're expecting me to fight this war with an army about a third of the size of what we envision in terms of the combat forces. You remember, like, 200 divisions was the original concept. Yeah. And you end up with 90 or so. And, you know, he's constantly bickering to try and get more of what they think of as the quality manpower. And we're doing this under the racial restrictions that basically say, well, if you're black, we're really not going to put you into combat because we don't think you'll fight. You know, so imagine being under that kind of institutional pressure with all these ridiculous contradictions. It's I think it's amazing that we did as well as we did. What happened, so the I'm only giving tendencies here, but the tendency as you get towards 1944, when really, from an American perspective, that's when the war begins on some levels, when we're really fighting most of our battles. You know, that's why we talk about this year being such an important marker year, all these anniversaries. By then, you know, the AAF has gotten much of what it needs. And they don't need as many aviation cadets anymore. You've got enough pilots, you know, you've got enough people in all these other kind of slots. And what the demand is for is combat infantry. Now, most people don't have any college degree or experience, between 10 and 20%. Only 40% have a high school diploma. So that tells you something about the education levels, but that doesn't necessarily mean someone isn't smart. So there is a meritocracy in play if you are white. That you can get access to be going to OCS or whatever if you score high enough in AGCT, if you do okay in basic training, you know, all that good stuff. Whether you really want that is another matter altogether, though, because that second lieutenant infantry slot is not exactly safe.
No, it's literally the worst, around, isn't it? I mean,
can you think of anything more dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, being a rifleman, maybe, depending on the circumstance. So it's we call out what's called the Army Specialized Training Program. And I don't know if you guys have heard of that. It's a program they created either right before the war or at the beginning, in which you take the sort of cream of the Army's manpower, at least as they think of it, people who score like way high on the AGCT, and they send them to college on the Army's dime. So you're basically going to get to sit out the war for a while, get a college education, become either a linguist, an engineer, you know, something like that. Probably get commissioned or get senior NCO rank, and then get a pretty decent billet. Eventually, they kill the program more or less altogether. And a lot of these tens of thousands of whiz kids, as they're often called, are then sent to combat units, and, you know, usually in an infantry capacity. Famously, the 99th Infantry Division gets a lot of guys. The 96th Division in the Pacific Theater that does a lot of fighting in the Philippines and Okinawa. If you've ever seen a movie, A Midnight Clear.
No.
Oh, I highly recommend that. Okay. Keith Gordon directed it. It stars Ethan Hawke, Frank Whaley, Kevin Dillon, Gary Sinise, Peter Berg. It's 1991, so it's when they were all really young, and it portrays these guys as, you know, former ASTPers who are part of an understrength INR squad on the eve of the Battle of the Bulge, and it's extremely well done, and it gives you a little bit of insight into that part of the American war effort of these guys who are really quite smart, and basically serving as infantry soldiers and everything that is going to kind of mean. So, but again, remember, this is always sort of racially biased, because if you were black, you're probably not going to have those opportunities for all the reasons we've talked about many times. And so we're using a lot of our talent, but not all. And that's what strikes me after all these years. As we said, too, if you were Latino, if you were Asian American, yeah, you could have these opportunities possibly, but it's primarily for whites. And the fighting and dying is too, right?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, the fighting and dying is too, yeah. I mean, the racial component is always the thing that sort of, we often take it in as we're talking, don't we? You circle around it, mm-hmm. because especially in this context, it always sort of seems really glaring, doesn't it?
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Putting it together, if there are no tours of duty, so you're in. If you're injured, you're recycled as soon as you possibly can be. If you're lucky, the army asks you your opinion. How do people how do you keep yourself together in this sort of environment? This is the question, isn't it? Is it mail? Is it your friends? Is it R&R that's for you to let off steam? What's the army doing to sort of keep people together? You know, keep themselves together.
Well, I think the Army does a lot to try and make sure that these combat soldiers are fed reasonably well, that they're clothed well, that they have decent weapons and all that. Now, they don't succeed on every plane, of course, and they can't do anything about the weather or whatever. They can do something about the mail. And I think depending on where you serve, your mail service is going to be pretty good. Of course, famously in the European theater, we've got a lot of our mail gummed up in a warehouse, and the 6888 has to sort this out and all that. That's become a kind of a, you know, and it should be a famous story now. Yeah. But really, I would say in many cases, you don't, you know, as an average soldier, you really don't hold up. Our combat fatigue rates in a typical infantry division in Europe are 15% and above. And I don't think that's unique. And so the question is how they're dealing with that, because, I mean, the three of us, we might get physical wounds, but also it's possible we have combat fatigue. And so what do we do about that? Do we just, you know, do the doctors just send us home and treat us as mental cases or something? Or do we try and treat the three of us and recover us and get us back? Increasingly, they're going to be doing the latter. Because they're partially because of the ruthlessness of the environment. But I also say they were finding that people were doing better because they in other words, if you permanently evacuated somebody with combat fatigue, there was a better chance that they really were going to develop permanent mental issues. And vice versa. Most people did not really want to be evacuated from the line. They were just at the end. They were fatigued on some levels, and they felt very guilty about leaving their mates, you know, on the lurch, on the line, and they wanted to get back, and that would provide a sense of self-worth. So increasingly, the Army was treating people that way and getting them back, really, whether they were ready or not is the other question. But that's the sort of pattern throughout the war. We tend to think of this as Europe, but it was going on in the Pacific big time. And the way the battle in which this really plays out, and they learn a great deal, is not a famous one, but it's the Battle of New Georgia in the middle of 1943. The 43rd Infantry Division is a New England National Guard unit. And it's fighting in the tropics. And not that it's a bad unit, but it's not quite prepared for what it's going to face in the tropics against the Japanese and night fighting and all this kind of stuff. So their combat fatigue rates are just through the roof. Initially, you just think, all right, just get these guys out of the way, because if they're still there, they'll instill panic in everybody else. Eventually, they start to figure out, no, we need to treat them and send them back. The rest of the Army is kind of learning from that experience, both Europe and Pacific.
That notion that if you separate a man, you know, the social cohesion is really, really important to the individual. And that I think is, again, you kind of think instinctively, you'd think, well, get him away from things and it'll be all right. Was that actual fact, get him away for a little while, get him, you know, the British developed this thing of making sure someone gets, that you get enough sleep, don't they? The British do a thing where they sedate you basically for a couple of days, knock you out.
Same thing with the Americans.
And that fatigue is central to it, that what you're trying to do is put gas back in the guy's tank rather than take him away, because he take away from his friends after all.
And that's why people are fighting. And those surveys reveal that too. And I think that's great data on combat motivation. And I mean, that is really the nut of it, is that's where the guilt comes from. You know, again, using the example, just the three of us, if we're part of a rifle squad and we've become kind of tight and I just am uncontrollably shaking and crying and I can't go on the next attack or whatever, and they've got to evacuate me, I'm going to be really guilty if something happens to you guys and I'm not there. You know what I mean? And I think that's the typical kind of situation, not skulkers. That's a different category altogether, in a kind of a real minority.
Well, I've got to say that the amount of tears that are going on in Italy compared to writing about Normandy or Sicily is just enormous. Seriously, I mean, there's lots and lots of tears. There's lots of people breaking down, lots of people going, I can't go on. And that's because there's no question about it. They're pushed harder at this stage of the war and the conditions are worse. It's winter. Actually, ironically, because it's winter and they're no longer in Sicily, they're not getting as malaria as much. So they're not actually getting as ill as much. So they're not, you know, that's quite a useful time out. And they're just relentlessly in the front line feeling cold and wet. I mean, we've all been in that situation where you're outside and you're cold and it's raining and you get drenched through and all you want to do is get home, have a hot bath, sit in front of the fire, whatever.
Yep.
You can't do that. You're just stuck out there, freaking mountain or in this horrible plane or been a hedgerow in Northwest Europe somewhere, and there is no escape. And it's muddy and it's horrible and you're sick of the rations and you're sick of everybody. And the commanders don't know what the heck they're doing, because if they did know what they were doing, they sure as hell wouldn't have these 20-year-olds in this misery. So it's all their fault and it's all the fault of the stupid krautheads. And it's just horrible. And I'm totally, totally sympathetic. I mean, I've just been reading about this guy, this young lieutenant in the Texas division, and you know, he's in charge of the mortar platoon. They get moved, and they get moved to a much safer place where their mortars are, because they're now on the kind of, you know, just watching the side of the another division. And So they're all really, really happy about that. But then the lieutenant says, well, okay, we've got to go and set up an OP up on the high ground. And they take it in turns to man the OP, where obviously, you know, the one person that you want to get as an enemy, as a German, if you're being attacked by the Allies, more than anyone else, is the observer, the forward observer. So no one wants to be in this position because you're getting mortared and shelled the whole time. And the moment you move as a sniper or a machine gun or whatever. And there's this sergeant, this buck sergeant, which I think is a sergeant fifth class, right? It's like the junior sergeant. And he just says, I'm not going up there. I can't do it. And the lieutenant goes, no, you've got to do it. Everyone else has done it. You've got to go. It's your turn. He's just going, I cannot do it. I won't do it. Then he breaks down. And actually, they go, right, just get the back of the line. And he ends up being a driver for the rest of the war.
Does he? Yeah. And so he had then, it's interesting then, that whole dynamic. Because he kind of stayed with the unit, but he always maybe had that stigma, for lack of a better word. He had to live with that.
And everyone, yeah, he had a massive stigma. No one talked to him. And, you know, he avoided ever talking to his infantry mates again and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, it's so awful.
It's and, so you know, awful.
And, let's pull back the lens a little bit. So imagine if we just met him, you know, decades later, and we knew, wow, this guy served in Italy in World War II with the 36th Division. He was there, and we would have all these assumptions, but probably he doesn't want to talk about any of it because he's got all that guilt, those layers of guilt that are probably dealt up over decades then, too. This is where all the nuances of this really start to come into play, and why it's a little disconcerting on some levels now, 80 years later, because just the interpersonal dynamics of a combat unit at the front are kind of lost to us now because most of the people are lost to us. Do you know what I mean? I mean, we know what had gone on in our rifle squad. That's not going to end up in the records, you know? All of that little interplay sometimes gets lost. And that's why sometimes it's, you know, you don't disagree with the sort of larger marker anniversaries and all that. We'll hear about heroics and this and that this year. All those other layers and nuances, I think, sometimes get lost. And that's years ago, I had this passion for trying to document as much as possible while these guys were around. And even then, it's hard to sometimes get past the veneer and really know what happened. You know, that too. Yeah.
This is by that lieutenant, who was trying to get the sergeant up to the OP. And he says, a profound depression settled over me as the rain kept up. The war would never end, and we would have to go on until we were all killed, fighting in the Rocky Mountains and being shelled, sleeping in the slush. Or we would break the way my sergeant had and not be able to take any more OPs. In Italy, there would always be another mountain with Germans on the high ground having all the advantage.
Spike Milligan. Spike Milligan is going up to an OP, isn't he, when he's mortared?
No one wants to be on an OP. And who can blame them?
Who would? This is the nut of it, because that is the challenge of this situation, is the sameness of it all, the opaque nature of everything. We don't know. As historians, we know the ins and outs of every attack. I mean, Jim knows the Rapido situation better than Mark Clark did, probably. Yeah. When you were a rifleman at the time, it was all just sort of this randomness of, okay, we got to go here today and there tomorrow. And it's just, we're miserable today. We're going to be miserable tomorrow. There's no end to it. And how would you hold up in that? I mean, that's points to out to something that I've argued for years, this idea of determinism about World War II, which I've pushed back against so often because of like, oh, well, you know, once you got the big three together, the war is over. The Allies are going to win. And the Americans, I mean, it's once they're in, it guarantees it because they've got stuff. Yeah. No, it doesn't. Because how many people are going to have to deal with situations like this in which you're living in this hopeless world, having to go and fight like this? How many people are going to do it? You know, how many people are going to be able to lead properly and figure out how to bring something out of this and all this? Yes, you've got advantages, but it doesn't guarantee anything.
I think that's true. And I think...
Certainly not when the other side are mobilized in the way they are or motivated in the way they are. They are too.
And have excellent defensive weapons as they do, even as they're declining, you know, in terms of their manpower, of course, admittedly, but they don't have to be that great, you know, to nail you at casino or whatever, do they? I mean, they've got plenty of firepower and they have enough resolve.
The big issues in the casino battles is particularly the Monte Cassino bit up in the mountains. It's that no one knows what the heck's going on because the CP of the regiment, the command post of the regiment, is down in the valley floor or lower slopes anyway. They're not right on the top of the massive where the ridges are. They're not on Snake's End Ridge or Phantom Ridge or Monte Castellone or any of these places. They're not up there. And they can't get up there even if they wanted to get up there because mule trails are too crowded and, you know, that's not the place for them in a way. And so up there, they're dependent on these infantry battalions and companies and platoons pushing forward. But the problem is all the officers are getting killed. So new guys come up and they go, where's the 2nd Battalion? Everyone goes, oh no, somewhere up there. So they kind of head up this trail, dead bodies everywhere. It's all getting a bit high and stinking. There's carnage everywhere. There's shells going over. They're kind of crouching every kind of fourth yard. Eventually they get up somewhere and goes, do you know where the 2nd Battalion are? Yeah, they're over in that broken down hut. They get into the broken down hut. Anyone here from the 2nd Battalion? Yeah, this guy is. Yeah, you're just going to have to wait. I'm busy right now. I'm trying to deal with this kind of crap that's going on kind of 40 yards up ahead and what the hell's happened to my platoon that I've just sent up to Snake's Head, you know, up to Point Vine 3. Okay, so what's going on? I don't know. I'm the fucking hell what's going on. You know, I'm just trying to find out where my platoon are. Bang! You know, someone gets killed. Quite often, the officer that's been sent up to find out what the hell's going on never makes it back anyway. Then a random shell comes down and actually hits the CP, so the regimental commander's killed anyway. So how can the generals possibly work out what the hell's going on? So then another division comes in to take over from the division that's been badly mauled, and there's only kind of 7 people standing from one platoon and, you know, 82 standing in the entire battalion. They've been told confidently by the guys down below, the staff officers down below of the division that's exiting, that X has been taken, and they're holding it. Well, it was taken 24 hours ago, but it's now been taken back again by a counterattack, and no one has a clue what's going on. And that cohesion which you need to be able to progress a battle just hasn't happened.
No, and that's the way it goes.
And the problem with the generals is the generals need to understand this. They need to understand the limitations of what can be achieved. And the point is on Casino is they're not doing that. They're not able to understand that. And that applies equally to instances in the Battle of the Bulge on, you know, Schoenberg or cases in Normandy or wherever it might be. You know, you're in the Cotentin Peninsula and you're pushing forward. What was that division that was really bad and all the commanders can't get
the 90th struggled initially, did not have good senior leadership.
Yeah, the 90th struggled, then they came good. But the reason the 90th
struggled, that became an excellent unit.
Right. But the reason, one of the reasons why the 90th struggled to start off with, A, is because the divisional command is not strong enough. The cohesion isn't strong enough. But what happens is the moment they get into these Bocage field fights, there seems to be no way through because a lot of these fields are kind of, let's say they're roughly square. They're not always square, but they're roughly square. Sometimes they can be triangular, sometimes it'd be whatever. But the bottom line is you're pushing through a hedgerow and you know that on the far side of the field, there's going to be some German machine gunners. And in the field beyond that, there's going to be some mortar men. And also next to the machine gunners are going to be some observers for the mortars, plus some other infantry. There's only one way you can do that, and that is sort that out. And that is by getting a tank in there, which is resistant to most mortars and certainly to small arms. And that tank needs to go in there and go boom, boom, boom with its 75mm gun and spray the whole hedge line with machine gun bullets, with the infantry advancing behind it. And then the infantry do the line the last bit and just clear it all out. If you don't have that firepower, if you don't have that mobile firepower to support you, there's only one way of doing that, and that is scuttling along the hedgerows and getting shot to pieces. And everyone knows that. And the problem is the commanders above know that they're sending these platoons in who are not coming back or coming back in kind of twos and threes because everyone else has been shot and killed and a whole squad's gone down. And they're trying to make sense of what's going on. And then the battalion commander is going, you know, Chuck, what the hell's going on down there? And it's like, well, I'm trying to get a picture of it. Will you just get your ass up there and get that field? And no one knows what the hell's going on except that everyone's getting killed. And until someone just goes, whoa, okay, let's just take a time out here and let's just think about this rationally and let's just try and analyze what's happening. Let's try and kind of think about this and work out a solution. Then you can accelerate. But because everyone's in such a hurry in the war, there's no time to stop. No one can stop. You always got to just keep going. You've got to keep pressing on. That's one of the failings, I think, of the Allied leadership in the Second World War is they're starting to win. They can't, that gulf between the grunt at the front getting shot to pieces in the field or on the mountain or in the forest of the Ardennes or wherever it might be, battalion to regimental to divisional commander, that chain at that level, that's the one that's not working because there's a disconnect there. And the pressure from the top, from the right of the top down to the division, down to the regiment, down to the battalion, and then obviously to the companies, is too great. And everyone's just going, you just got to push it. You just got to push it. And actually, the Americans tend to drive their men harder than you would imagine. You know, there is a ruthlessness. There was a ruthlessness to Mark Clark when he's saying, you know, we've got to just kill all these Germans. We've got to get them. And you know, which he's writing in that missive in December 1943. Although the Americans have this incredible capacity for learning the lessons and absorbing them very, very quickly, there's not enough pauses. There's not enough. That didn't work quite as well as it might have done. Let's just sit and think about this for a minute. You know, why did the Rapido not work? You know, is Fred Walker right that, you know, it was never going to get across there? No, he probably wasn't right. You know, it's probably because you're just not applying what you've got properly. But if you've got no time to actually sit and think about this and work it out, because the pressure from above is so great, you're just shuffled into one kind of catastrophe after another. That's the problem.
But I remember when we were talking over Christmas about this, when I said, well, why don't they just pause for a month?
You can't because of the pressure from above.
The pressure from above means that you can't put things on hold and lick your wounds.
Right. So I blame the guys at the top. I blame the guys at the top.
As you would have done in the, you know, in the previous campaigning season shape of things, you wouldn't be fighting now, would you? You'd have all gone home. Yeah. Basically, reconvene in the spring, wouldn't you? That's the thing.
In the old days, yeah. Yeah, well, and in the U.S. Marine Corps and the U.S. Army, your reputation as a senior leader, you wanted it to be aggressive. If you got that reputation as being, you know, namby-pamby, you don't push your people or whatever, that's death knell to your career and probably to your opportunities. And the other thing that's kind of mind-blowing about this, we are properly blaming the guys at the very, very top, right? The political leadership and the strategic leadership of constantly pushing. And I think one of the reasons they're doing that is they're under societal pressure, at least certainly in the U.S., of how long is this war going to go on? How long are we going to have to endure rationing? How long can we amp up our economy towards this end and keep drafting people and sustain that? And so from President Roosevelt on down, there's a sense of, okay, we're paying gobs of money every day. We're losing people every day. You know, when will it end and how can we get the thing moving? It was the same in the Civil War, too. Lincoln's
and that in the end is how you end constantly. Up that is in the end how you end up dropping an atomic bomb, isn't it?
It makes total sense in that context, I suppose, right? Yeah. I mean, so it's and the other thing too, I think, to kind of step back and think about sociologically, I think certainly on the eve of the war, especially with how much glamour was attached to the whole aerial side of the equation and whatnot, and how a lot of guys were attracted to that. There was a bit of a stigma of being in the infantry and whatnot, a kind of a social stigma and whatever. And I do think that that's one thing that really starts to change during World War II on some levels. And one of the reasons is Ernie Pyle and him kind of really humanizing and showing how important the infantry were. But also he plays a role in the advent of what's called the combat infantry badge, which I'm sure you guys have heard of or seen. Which is a special decoration that only goes to the infantry and only goes to combat infantry and along with extra pay and prestige and all that. That's implemented in 1944, meaningfully, and it is in place ever since. So no matter how high a rank you have or whatever, if you are not an infantryman who has seen combat trading bullets with the enemy, you can't get the combat infantry badge. And that's a really, really big deal to this day. And I do think that that's one of the things that leads to a little more status for the infantry. And also, I think recognition as the war unfolds of just how vital they really were by everybody involved and the universal respect that infantry had, no matter who you were in the war.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I think anyone who serves in the infantry in World War II deserves just unparalleled respect, as I would also agree with, you know, as I would also say about those frontline troops in Ukraine at the moment. I mean,
because
what is so horrifying about Ukraine is all the stuff that I'm seeing and reading about and the kind of, you know, the snippets of diaries and stuff that are starting to creep out and get into the kind of public domain about the war in Ukraine. It's exactly the same. You know, you have no chance. Yes, you're going to get killed. You're going to get wounded. The casualty rates amongst Russian troops particularly are absolutely catastrophic off the radar. They're obviously terrible for the Ukrainians as well. It's trench warfare, it's foxholes, it's mud, it's dirt, it's misery, it's rain, it's snow, it's freezing cold, there's all the privations. It is exactly the same. There's no difference at all. There's machine guns, there's small arms, there's assault rifles, hand grenades. You know, now you've got horrible drones as well with missiles on, but it's kind of, you know, but really the nature of it is all exactly the same. And
there's no end in sight. Critically, that's the point.
So, you know, it's an absolute horror story. And you have to wonder how man gets himself into this situation. You're expecting young men to go through this. You know, what they went through in the Second World War is just it's unbelievable. You know, and that's whether you're German or Japanese or Russian or American or British or New Zealander or whatever, Canadian.
But to connect this hard to, you know, but this is the Way of Ways USA, the America isn't threatened by.
No, it's incredible.
The Germans. Arguably, its sphere of influence is threatened by the Japanese in the Pacific. But yeah, you can understand why a Ukrainian is fighting, but why an American doughboy halfway up some mountain in December of 1943, crouching in a puddle as he's mortared by Germans who are absolutely determined that they're saving Germany, evil outside forces, and they're wrong, or that their thinking's warped. You know, how on earth you propel a doughboy up that mountain and back down over the other side, then up the next one, then back down the side of the other one, and then we've got skin in the game here in the UK because our cities have been bombed. You know, what once it sort of exits our traditional continental requirement, which is that the lowlands aren't occupied by an enemy or threaten us, which is the sort of core principle reason for, you know, overmighty European power and all that stuff, which is the thing that drives British foreign policy or until the end of the Second World War. You know, this, how is a bloke from Wisconsin doing this? How is a dude from Texas possibly interested? But you could persuade people with an abstract idea about freedom. Freedom is under assault. Yeah, but not here, it isn't. Not in Texas, it isn't.
No, I mean, I remember clearly standing at the foot of Monte Altuzzo, which is one of the best preserved battlefields in Italy. It's up in the Apennine, so it's on the Gothic line, and it's near the Jogo Pass. And there's a kind of, the road winds up to the pass, but the foot of Altuzzo is off the saddle down to the left. And you go into this lovely little sort of farm pasture and little ground. And there is this massive razor-backed horseshoe of rock up above, which I think it was the 88th Division or was it the 85th? I can't remember. Have to scale. And I remember vividly standing at the foot of this field, looking up at where the Americans scaled and just thinking, I'm a GI from, you know, Des Moines.
Right.
I'm from Des Moines.
Absolutely. We're making an honorary Midwesterner.
Yeah, yeah, there you are. So I'm from the Midwest. I'm from the Midwest, and I'm looking up at that, and I'm just thinking, what the heck am I doing? Why am I here? What am I doing? Why have I got to die for this? And
yeah,
and I think that's what a lot of people wondered.
You know, and often, you know, in the case of kind of, you know, troops crossing the Rapido or at Anzio, you're dying in some horrible corner of a mountain or some awful, ghastly field of reclaimed pontine marshes because there aren't enough landing ships. You know, because there's not enough bits of metal.
I know.
That's why you're dying, and that's not a good thought, is it?
No, it isn't. And in the case of Europe, maybe the answer is Hitlerism. A lot of people wanted to just excise Hitlerism from the world, I suppose, if there was any, you know, ideology about it. In the Pacific, it's a different motivation and a kind of a darker motivation on some levels. This is a racial and cultural war. Yeah. The incredible anger that follows Pearl Harbor that animates many Americans the rest of the war, and a determination to basically put the Japanese in their place, as many would have thought it at the time, and to basically fight and win this racial war. They're not looking at that way in Europe, but Hitler is sort of the villain. Americans always need a villain, and I think maybe that's something in the motivation, but I also think it's amazing, too, because, like you guys just said, you're far away from home. Do you really have skin in the game with this or not? I don't know. I mean, it's people are still ambivalent to this day, unfortunately. But and the other thing too is that you know, we've flirted with some of these same ideas that Hitler embraces on some levels. I mean, Jim Crow is basically a Nazi ideology, if we're, you know, being honest. It's a fascist oriented ideology. So here we are bringing out the best in ourselves, though, of fighting to destroy something like that, that could have destabilized the planet, Adolf Hitler's Germany, you know, and everything that's going to mean for the future, and especially African-American veterans who are a part of this, too. That's why World War II is so profoundly important socially for the United States, because it leads to major racial changes that were, yeah, you know, the problems were festering for decades, you sure know. So it's, you know, but over 100,000 Americans are going to lose their lives from D-Day through the end of the war in Germany in that next less than a year. I mean, that's kind of a staggering total. And you add that blood debt in addition to the blood debt from World War One. And of course, we're not even including the Mediterranean in this. That adds up to me, that adds up to NATO. And that adds up to, this is an American commitment to secure, to commit itself to Europe's security and to this alliance that we had back then that is still sort of in place today. And, you know, yeah, Jim, you mentioned Ukraine. I mean, it's still the same issue on some levels, yep, too. So
scary stuff.
It's amazing how relevant. Yeah, it is. It really is.
Anyway.
Fantastic.
Oh, well, that's a great conversation.
Well, thanks, everyone. Yeah, it's a tremendous conversation. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We will see you all again very soon with more rabbit holes. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
See ya.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.